U.S. equities advanced today, with the Nasdaq surging 1.4% as U.S. Treasury yields retreated. Meanwhile, a U.S. clinical trial validated the AstraZeneca vaccine, finding it to be 79% effective. And in other news, the Turkish lira crashed 14% as Turkish President Erdogan fired Central Bank Chief Naci Abal. That's the news of the day. Now, with her analysis on gold, banks, and the dollar, here's Lynn Alden.
Lynn, welcome back to Real Vision. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me again.
Of course. So, Lynn, the last time you were on, you laid out your thesis that rates were going to rise. You were very bullish on the reflationary names, your energy stocks, your commodity stocks. That has all come to pass. But it's now my understanding that it's not so much you're having doubts, but you're pulling a little bit away from that reflation trade just because it's so crowded. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so it's often like if you look at, say, a control system, we have a big response and you have a pullback in the other direction as it tries to find equilibrium. I'm kind of seeing that happen in the markets now. And so if you look, of course, back in 2020, we really overshot on all of the growth stock names, all of the kind of no profit, hyper growth things. Everybody piled into those at any price. Nobody wanted anything to do with the cyclicals, with the more economically sensitive names. Then, starting in the autumn when we got the vaccine announcements and we started to see, some of this policy response really start to kick in, everybody piled back into these really oversold cyclical stuff. And so we've seen like small cap, we've seen energy stocks, we've seen banks, all these different things flying up to different degrees in a very short amount of time. And so in many ways, I think some of those things might have overshot, maybe not to the same extent that some of those really growthy names overshot last year, but we have come very, very far, very fast. So I've been scaling back some of my reflationary trades a little bit over the past weeks, including, for example, selling, the copper stocks that have done extraordinarily well and just kind of, looking back at some of the things that haven't done very well in the past few months, like some of the growth stock names and things like that.
Lynn, I want to get into that, but first, can you lay out your broad thesis on your macro thesis about how you're thinking about growth and inflation? We're reaching the point where expectations are for inflation are very high, perhaps 3 to 4%. But I understand you're making a point that it actually might not be such a big deal because it's comparing to the last year. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. So if you look at base effects, right? So if you look at what CPI has done, let's say first you look at it in just not rate of change terms, just CPI, you'll see that there was a dip, back during the spring of last year, the April, May timeframe, when we were kind of in the heart of the job losses and things like that. So now going forward, when we get to April and May reported, the months after May and June, we're going to have CPI prints that are most likely, somewhat on the high side. There's a decent chance of having an over a 3% headline CPI print. That's because you're comparing it year over year to the April and May of last year where we had that big dip. And so the market should understand this, but I see, more often than not that, a lot of people don't really focus on the base effects. And so, for example, a lot of people were surprised that February numbers didn't come in super high. But they had actually pretty strong base effects to compare with back in 2020, and so now we're gonna have the opposite thing. It starts a little bit, in the March report, but really in April and May is where you have those super low base effects, and so it's gonna be interesting to see how the bond market absorbs that when we start to get some of these substantial CPI prints. And Jerome Powell is already aware of this. And so, for example, they pointed out that we're going to have these base effects, that we're gonna have these transient headline numbers. And the Fed's narrative is to look past that. And we're going to see how they kind of navigate the market through that situation.
Lynn, I'm glad that you mentioned the base effects. You've got this key chart of the 10-year Treasury rate to the consumer price index. And one thing I note is that the 10-year Treasury rate, the purple line, has been beneath the actual inflation rate for quite some time, meaning that real rates are actually negative. And that's been an environment that's been very good for gold. But over the past few months, we've seen that delta narrow and real rates are budging up. What's your outlook for real rates going forward?
So a little bit less certain now, because a lot of this past move, we've had rising inflation expectations, but then nominal yields have risen even faster because they're catching up from such a deep trough. And so going forward, it's quite possible that rates take a break for a little bit while inflation levels inch up, partially due to these base effects. And so, you know, we've gotten pretty oversold on gold. We've seen a little bit of strength out of that recently, especially compared to what some of the real rates are still doing. And so it's kind of a transition point that I'm watching pretty closely because, you know, gold has closely tracked those real rates where, you know, back in August of last year, you know, we saw, you know, real rates bounce up from a little bit worse than negative 1%. They started for the 10-year, they started to go up. And that's when gold sold off. We've been in this multi-month correction for gold. We've been in this multi-month, bear market in bonds, rising yields and real yields. And that's kind of getting a little bit wobbly now, I think, where yields are still, I think, longer term looking up, but they have come so far so fast. It has become consensus that yields are going to rise. It's become consensus that gold is out of favor. And so I'm watching for a potential consolidation point here. And so that's how I'm kind of reading that space.
Yeah, just to go back to those key base effects, most things are measured in year-over-year change. So inflation for next month, for April, is going to be compared to April 2020, where the entire world, and especially the U.S. economy, was in a state of disaster. 20 million people had just lost their jobs. So comparing the inflation, the consumer price index, to that, it will actually give a higher number than would be normal. And the way that I like to think about that is just a cruise liner. You know, a cruise liner can say, you know, our revenue in Q2 2020 was $1 million. It was extremely low. It plummeted 99.5%. It went from, you know, billions of dollars to just one $1 million. And then if it goes to $1 billion again, you know, what is that? You know, a multi-thousand percent year-over-year increase, but it's not. It's you're comparing it to, you know, one of the worst times of all. So I think that it's really good that you're bringing up the base effects. But so on the one end we have CPI, and that is base effects because that's a piece of economic data. You don't really trade that. But then on the other hand we have the TIPS market, which has real yields, and then we have nominal yields, and both of those are real markets. And in other words, that the price is set by supply and demand. It's so you don't really have base effects. There. You mentioned that you're a little unsure on real rates going forward. Do you think that the rise in nominal rates, which of course is what everyone's talking about, do you think that has gotten a little bit long in the tooth, or do you still think that you know, long run, you think rates will continue to rise?
I still think there's a decent chance they continue to rise, but maybe not as fast as people thought. And so they've come so far so fast, and people are like, sure, this is going to be a wrecking ball and keep causing problems. And maybe it will, but once something becomes so known, that's almost when the market tends to trick you the other way. And so I do think they have higher to go, but even when you have a long-term direction in mind, doesn't mean the market goes there in a straight line. And so it wouldn't be surprising to me to see a period of consolidation. And it's funny because if you look back in history, I mean, you know, obviously the 10-year spends the majority of its time higher than official CPI inflation. And yet, it's been a pretty big chunk of time here, you know, below the headline inflation numbers. And so even if you don't get significant inflation, the 10-year naturally wants to pull back up to a period of positive real yields. But the challenge there is that there's so much debt in the system, whether you look at public debt, whether you look at, you know, the leverage in you know, all these different, you know, credit markets, and looking at what's happening with housing, which has really been kind of a driver of economic activity in recent quarters. That a lot of that is threatened by those rising yields. And so we're going to watch basically to see the reflationary effect happening, but then it's going to, you know, run into these higher real yields, or we're going to see how the market absorbs that. And one of the tricks that the Fed still has up their sleeve that they've been resistant to use yet is to suppress the long end of the curve. And so for as long as economic growth continues and nothing is quote-unquote breaking in either the plumbing system or credit markets or things like that, they have a decent incentive to kind of let it play out and see, you know, if a fire develops for them to put it out.
Yeah. Firstly, Lynn, I'm glad that you brought up housing. Today, actually, there is a month-over-month data coming out on existing home sales in the U.S., and it was actually down 6.6%, whereas the median survey was down only 3%. So, you know, as you know, housing has been at the vanguard of the rally. So the fact it's slowing down is you know, perhaps causing people to scratch their heads. But Lynn, I'm really glad that you brought up yield curve control, because I want to get in the weeds on the different part of the curve. You know, the violence in the yield curve started a few weeks ago in the belly of the curve, that 7-year auction. But it continued to the 10-year, the 20-year, and the 30-year, you know, obviously marked by TLT, which has had a drawdown, I believe, over 20%. Meanwhile, on the extreme short end of the curve, I think you had a chart on Twitter, the one-month Treasury bill actually briefly went negative, or was very close to going negative, just as it did during last year, during March and April. So my question for you, Lynn, is, what's your outlook on the different parts of the curve? Last week, we said, Powell was very reticent to mention yield curve control at all. He got very many prompts from journalists, and he sort of brushed it off, essentially evaded the question. What did you think of that, and how do you think that Fed Chair Powell and the Federal Reserve will orient itself towards yield curve control in the future?
One way to approach it is, I treat the short end of the Treasury curve and the long end of the Treasury curve as almost separate asset classes, even though they're all Treasuries. They almost couldn't be more different. I mean, the types of buyers are different, the reasons to buy them are different, and so that's why simultaneously we've seen kind of a lack of sufficient number of T-bills out there. There's this demand for collateral compared to the amount of liquidity in the system, and that's driven those yields super low. Because those T-bills are in high demand. On the other side, not a lot of investors have wanted to own these really long-term bonds at a time when, their yields are below, both the Fed's intended inflation rate for the long run and below, even what inflation was currently happening, especially in a policy environment of such rapid broad money supply creation. And so it's natural for that longer-term stuff to want to push up in yield. While at the same time, there's a ton of demand for the short-term stuff. And in some ways, that was the opposite of what we saw in late 2019 with the repo spike, where you had too many T-bills relative to the available liquidity. And in this period, you're finding the opposite. And so the result is we're getting a very, very steep yield curve. That's been good for banks. And it's also been somewhat negative for gold, because gold closely follows that real yield relationship. The Fed did throw a little bit of water on that bank trade, in the past, last week when they announced that they're not going to extend, the SLR relief. And so that took a little bit of the wind of the sails out of the banks. And so that's another thing that it came very far, very fast. Something I've been bullish on. When we started to see it go up like that consistently, basically that slows it down a little bit. And so I think we're in an environment now where we've gotten some of the major moves out of the way. We saw the tech stock outperformance. We saw this really run up. Then we saw that correct. We saw the run up in these value stocks. We've seen the run up in yields. And now I think the market's kind of sorting through all this, and it's less binary, right? So you had the disinflationary market close. Then you had the reflationary policy response, the reflationary opening idea. And now as we're looking at actual reopening, it's kind of varied, right? So it's more nuanced. And so if you look at Europe, they're still having vaccine issues. They're having reopening issues. Places like the United States are moving forward quicker on that. And so it becomes a geographical issue. Like it's not just that the whole world's on one page. We have kind of China, Europe, and the United States all on kind of different chapters of this. We also see that, we're no longer, it was super consensus to never touch oil. And then we saw a really strong move in oil. And then lately we've been pairing that a little bit. And so I think some of these really giant moves we got that out of our system. And going forward, it's really about nuance. It's really about, individual stocks, individual valuations. I think that even though that valuation's been like a dirty word in the past couple of years, I think that's likely going to start coming back here, where we have to kind of look at individual assets on their own merits.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Yeah, Lynn, your sizable subscriber base knows you as someone who's very comfortable swimming in both the macro pool and the micro pool. But perhaps some of our users at Real Vision who only know you through Real Vision think of you as a macro thinker. So I definitely want to get into the micro and the specific stocks you're thinking and how you're orienting your own portfolio. But I do, before we do that, Lynn, I really want to talk about the SLR, the decision not to to let the supplementary leverage ratio or the exemption on that expire. Quickly, can you just tell us what is the supplementary leverage ratio and why it's so important?
So that's basically a measure of you know, how much available liquidity banks have compared to their asset base. And so basically back in March and April of last year, you know, we had a severe dysfunction in the treasury market. And it was just a very kind of unusual time in general. And so the Federal Reserve suspended that rule, which basically allowed banks to have more bank reserves and more treasuries than they might otherwise have. Basically, those didn't count against that ratio, and which makes sense because they're virtually risk-free assets. And so that was a way to basically give banks more flexibility. And, you know, there were a bunch of write-ups on what that means for markets. And so, for example, JP Morgan put out a piece back then saying that essentially this allows banks to buy more treasuries, which then, you know, the Fed can buy from them. And it makes QE easier, and it just kind of improves liquidity in the treasury market. That worked out pretty well. Now, banks in some ways didn't heavily use those, you know, because they know that they don't want to be caught off guard when that gets pulled away. But we did see, you know, some banks dip into that to different degrees. And we also saw that as we neared expiration, banks are behaving in a somewhat uncertain way because they have to kind of start assuming that it's not going to be extended. Overall, that can potentially, with the fact that that's expiring and the banks are going to go back to the previous rules, that puts some limits on, you know, how much bank reserves they can have, how much treasuries they can hold, whether or not they can even accept deposits in some cases, or whether or not they're going to push some, you know, clients to using other forms of you know, kind of cash management, that's what's throwing some water on this bank stock rally, where they're benefiting very significantly from the increase in the deposit base. They're benefiting from the steepness of the yield curve. But now, you know, they're kind of being put back to reality where they still have to be very careful with the overall size of their balance sheet. And so overall, it shouldn't be a massive change to banks, but it does, you know, show that there's some degree of normalization here. And the thing that I would really watch is that treasury market, right? Because it basically, you know, makes that a little bit less flexible to manage, especially if you look later in this year when there's expected to be a lot of issuance. Because right now, you almost have the other side of the coin where there's not a ton of issuance because we're drawing down the TGA, you know, the Treasury General Account. Whereas later this year, once that TGA is drawn down, they have to go back to, you know, basically funding their spending with issuance. And then the question is, what are the available buyers for them? Are yields going to be high enough to attract foreign buying again? Because if banks can't buy a ton and domestic balance sheets only have so much capacity, it becomes a question of who's going to finance all that treasury issuance.
Thanks, Lynn. A lot to unpack there. Yeah, it's my understanding that the supplementary leverage ratio is the ratio of Tier 1 equity in the numerator. So your equity, your common equity, your bank deposits, your other extremely safe assets, and then the denominator is essentially your entire leverage exposure, including off balance sheets, liabilities, and on balance sheets as well, of course. So it's my understanding that the SLR exemption, which occurred last year, exempted treasuries from the denominator. So
and reserves, treasuries and reserves.
Treasury. Thank you. Yes, treasuries and reserves. So that allowed, as you say, banks to increase their balance sheets, and as a result, their balance sheets swelled up with treasuries. I've got a question for you, Lynn. What was the maturity profile on those treasuries? Were they short duration?
It depends on the banks. They had a pretty broad array of them. There are people that go into the detail and look at those bank holdings more closely than I do. So I haven't closely tracked the overall duration average and if there's a big variance between banks.
Okay. There's the SLR when that exemption is expiring on the 31st. But then there's the TGA, the Treasury General Account. And I'm really glad you brought that up, Lynn, because you said that the issuance is coming down the road from the treasuries. In other words, that we haven't seen nothing yet so far. But it's my impression, just someone who follows the news very closely, is that we have had a lot of treasury issuance. The 7-year, the $62 billion worth of that, the 20-year, the 30-year. Are you saying that that basically was peanuts to what is going down the road? And can you tie that into the TGA, please?
Yeah, so there were a couple of different phases. And so in 2020, they basically issued an absolute enormous amount of treasuries, just utterly unprecedented. And of course, that was to fund an unprecedented amount of spending. Now, it wasn't as big of an issue because one is that the Federal Reserve bought a significant amount of treasuries, and therefore there was not a lot of treasuries for the private sector to absorb. But the quirk there is that they also the Treasury radically grew its TGA. And for people that aren't aware, basically the Treasury holds its excess cash with the Fed. It's basically like the Treasury's general account. And so if they issue a lot more treasuries, faster than they spend that money, it pulls up in the TGA. And if they spend more rapidly than they issue those bonds, they can draw down that TGA. And so in recent years, the TGA was often around $300 or $400 billion. But they drew the TGA up all the way to like $1.8 trillion. It was completely off the charts compared to all previous history, more than four times higher than previous tops. And it was unclear, there's all sorts of reasons why they were doing that. And then, of course, we had the switchover from Mnuchin to Yellen running the Treasury. And so they revised basically their plans for the TGA. And so every quarter, the Treasury tells you ahead of time what their estimated issuance is going to be, what they intended the TGA to look like by the end of that quarter. And so when Yellen took over, they revised that and basically, showed that they're going to reduce issuance compared to their previous plans. Which by extension means that they're going to draw down the TGA to fund spending more quickly than they were previously estimating that they were going to do. And so basically 2020 was a year of issuing more treasuries than spending, whereas the first half of this year is a period of spending more than you're issuing because you're drawing down that TGA. Now, it's one of those nuanced things because they are still issuing a significant amount of treasuries. It's just that spending is so much higher, and therefore you're drawing that down. You're not actually issuing a ton of treasuries, compared to baseline. But if you look out later this year, treasury issuance is expected to pick up because they won't be able to, keep drawing down that TGA. Once it's drawn down back to normal levels, they no longer have that to draw from. And that, of course, partially depend on, what happens in Congress, because the Treasury can only estimate so far in advance because they don't know what spending is going to occur. And so, for example, when the Treasury gave those estimated numbers months ago, they didn't know at the time if stimulus was going to pass or not. And now, as we talk now, we don't know what infrastructure spending might or may not pass later this year or early next year. But overall, if you kind of map out what's expected, like what the Federal Reserve said they're going to buy, basically with their current asset purchase plan, compared to the issuance we can kind of bake into the cake over the next year or so, there actually is going to be quite a bit of issuance probably later this year that the market's going to have to absorb.
Okay, so the drawdown in the TGA actually is bullish in absolute terms for treasuries because it's just money sort of flowing out of the system rather than new paper having to be issued, but ultimately Treasury is going to have to rebuild that up, and you're saying that the amount of paper that is going to have to be issued, the supply could just choke the market, and yields could continue to rise. Is that what you're saying?
Later this year. And so the first step, the next several months here is during that TGA drawdown phase. Now, there's not a huge sample size. Historically, TGA drawdowns have been somewhat bearish for the dollar, whereas TGA increases have been bullish for the dollar. And that's because essentially, a TGA is like limbo. You're pulling dollars into it, and they're not doing anything. And so when you're pulling dollars out of the system, that tends to be dollar bullish because the remaining dollars that are in there become more scarce in a sense. Whereas when you're putting dollars back into the system, then dollars become less scarce, and therefore they tend to have a more of a bearish track. But that's of course not the only variable to take into account. So on its own, a TGA drawdown should be somewhat dollar bearish. On the other hand, the increase in rates we've had has been dollar bullish, and the fact that the U.S. economy is growing more rapidly now than many peer countries, in part mainly because we've had some just larger fiscal stimulus, but then also because the potential for the vaccine rollout being more successful. And so the market's kind of balancing these two forces. And so for the past couple of months, we've had the rise in rates, where the TGA drawdown didn't really start in earnest yet. And so it was natural that the dollar bull, you know, side of that was winning to a significant degree. But now that we're in the kind of the heart of the TGA drawdown, it's unclear if that's going to maybe consolidate and the bear is going to take over again. And that's why currently I remain somewhat neutral. I'm watching certain levels overall. And I do think that that we're probably going to get a less sharp of an increase in the dollar than we saw, you know, maybe earlier this year. But it remains to be seen which force is going to be stronger.
Right. Got it. Thanks, Lynn. And it's my understanding that, for the past 2 years, you've been quite bearish on the dollar. And if you follow that correctly, that could have been a rainmaker trade. You're absolutely right about that. But Lynn, it's my understanding that right now you're a little less certain. You don't really have a strong view on the dollar because of what you just said, because the release valve, if you will, for volatility is rates. It's not currencies, right?
Exactly. So yeah, if they move to suppress the long end of the curve, then that forces markets to express the differences through currency relationships. But as long as they let yields mostly do what they want to do, it can express itself through rates. And so if you look at 2020, in many ways the Fed was more dovish than other central banks in the sense that their asset purchase program was larger. Even though they weren't willing to go the negative interest rate route, just the sheer amount of QE in the system and the sheer amount of spending basically made for a much more bearish condition for the dollar than other developed market currencies. But so far this year, we've had central banks kind of respond differently to the rise in rates. And so we have some like Japan and Australia that are doing explicit yield curve control. Then we have others like Europe that are essentially doing yield curve control or yield spread control without being explicit about it. But they're certainly talking down the long end of the curve, more than the Fed is. And then on the other side of the spectrum, we have the Fed, which is basically saying rising yields aren't a big deal. We're monitoring it. It's a healthy sign of a reflationary market. And so in some ways, it's all relative, of course, but the Fed's currently a little bit tighter than some of these other central banks that have been more apt to manipulate yields. And so as long as that dynamic continues, that particular variable is bullish for the dollar, but then it's going up against this big TGA drawdown. And that's why at the current time, I don't really have a very high conviction view about the dollar as I did, if we were having this conversation a year ago.
Understood. Thanks, Lynn. Really quick, before we move on to the micro, you mentioned the stimulus bill, which has recently passed, that $1.9 trillion bill that's going to support incomes as well as businesses. And it's got a whole litany of programs. You've got a chart which shows the, not that so much the correlation, but it's the personal income spike that happened as a result of the first stimulus check and then the second one. Do you expect a similar spike to happen now that these over half actually of these third stimulus checks are already out? And if that spike happens, how do you expect that to manifest itself in the economy and perhaps financial markets?
So I do expect that spike to happen. And also what makes this third spike interesting is that it's happening when the second spike hasn't gone away yet. We kind of break the stimulus down into a couple major components. And so a lot of people focus on the stimulus checks because, they show up a lot on some of these charts. But actually another really big factor was all the extended unemployment benefits. And so that's kind of been holding incomes higher than they otherwise would be in this environment. But then the real kickers are their stimulus checks because they go to people that even didn't lose their income at all. And then they just kind of get extra money on top. And so if you look at the first stimulus check, we saw this big jump in income. And then we saw this kind of slow decline. That's because, stimulus checks were rolling out pretty slowly. And we also had the federal unemployment benefits. And by the time that was basically all used up, the stimulus checks were months old at that point. Federal unemployment benefits had run out. Then Congress comes in and they pass a second round of checks. They extend the unemployment benefits. And we saw a second spike in income. And so now what's interesting is that this third spike is coming at a time when the second one hasn't, fully worn off yet. And so that kind of kicks up into high gear at the same time as those base effects are quite favorable, those really low base effects. And so that's kind of why I think it's pretty interesting this time, because as you roll into April and May, consumers have a ton of cash. We're potentially getting 3% headline CPI prints due to really low base effects. And so I'm kind of just curious to see how the Treasury market's going to respond to this, to see if they're going to agree with the narrative that it's transient and kind of look out and say, okay, we can absorb a couple months of high headline CPI because we don't think it's going to be persistent, or if the Treasury market is going to be caught off guard by this and kind of have this heightened volatility, especially with the Fed kind of, you know, committing not to, you know, move too aggressively to control the long end of the curve.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
5-1-0, declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Definitely. It definitely is an embarrassment of riches. Lynn, I want to ask how you are positioning your portfolio. You mentioned you're trimming some of your winners, a little bit of banks here, a little bit of energy there, some commodities, some copper. And it's my understanding that as the tech sell-off has evolved, you're viewing some stocks with, you know, maybe they weren't attractive 3 months ago when you could taste the reflationary wind and you really tell that was happening. But now that rates are rising and things are changing a little bit, and there's been such a move into value into these reflationary names, it's my understanding that you're viewing some tech names with a little bit of interest. One stock I was reading your premium report, which came out earlier this month, was Adobe. What can you tell me about that stock? Why are you interested in that?
Well, so one thing I find interesting is that the market has been very binary, and it's almost like you can look at the markets in kind of one second and see if this is a value day or a growth day, right? So it's like, it's either like the Dow's down and Nasdaq's up, or like Nasdaq's down like a ton and Dow's up, and you have these really kind of big differentials. And whereas in some ways the middle of the market has been the least exciting one, the ones that are, say, growth at a reasonable price, or you know, the ones that are like high quality value. It's always either the really kind of dumpster fire names that are doing great, or the super high growth names that are, you know. So we've had that really kind of wide polarity, and so the space that I've been finding some value in is that middle of the road space. And so there are some examples. It's stuff that is not being bought by the Robinhood crowd, but at the same time is, you know, not on the value side of the spectrum. And so, for example, Adobe is a company that's you know, well more than three decades old. It's a very established company. We all know them, but no one's excited about them, right? They're not a hot stock. And yet, they've done extremely well of the past 5 years because they've shifted towards a SaaS model, a subscription model. Therefore, they have more recurring revenue. They've actually accelerated growth because of that. They've made acquisitions. They diversify their product line. They've introduced AI. They've really kind of oriented themselves towards a cloud company, and so they've done it very well in that environment. And it's a stock that I've been long. I originally bought it back in January 2019 after they had that big tech sell-off in quarter four 2018, and then it did so well up through mid 2020 that I was like, well, now I'm nervous about it because the valuation went up faster than the underlying earnings, and so that's a stock that I trimmed. But now that it's been in a multi-month correction, it's getting a little bit more interesting again, and so I've been looking at layering back into it. Or another tactic I do is if I know there's a stock that's good but maybe a little bit rich, I'll say, okay, here's the price I'd rather buy it at, and so I'll sell a cash secured put and say I'll get paid. If it doesn't go down there, I'll get paid a good premium and basically, you know, put my money to use. And if we do get kind of a growth stock capitulation and the stock falls another, you know, 15%, I'll go ahead and scoop that up and be long from that cost basis. And it's just kind of like, you know, sort of a win-win as long as the underlying company fundamentals and overall valuation model are reasonably correct. And so that's an approach I've been doing with some of these companies. I've also been long Facebook, for example, which no one's excited about. It's every time it's in the headlines, it's generally not for great reasons. Same thing with some of the Chinese tech, where I've been saying, okay, a handful of these sort of companies have not done very well. but they're actually, you know, kind of appropriately valued compared to their, you know, forward expected growth rates. And so I've been doing the thing where I don't bet too heavily on one name, but I do pick up these little, you know, kind of somewhat oversold growth names.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I definitely think of Adobe as a stock that has staying power, as a product that has staying power. I'm pretty sure that this episode that we're filming right now will probably be cut on Adobe Premiere Pro. And when I say staying power, you know, thinking of Warren Buffett and those moats of, let's say you buy a can of Coca-Cola for $1, you're not going to buy a competing can of another cola for 98 cents just because you save 2 cents. It's like, no, you want Coca-Cola. And likewise, I'm thinking, you know, a lot of trained professionals who work in the film industry, as well as, you know, amateurs who are interested in this as well, if they have a certain skill set on Adobe, they're progressing on the Adobe scale. They don't want to necessarily learn something new. So that's a really interesting trade, Lynn, and good to get you talking on the micro. Lynn, as we reach a close, my final question for you is the following. I know you've been very bullish on Bitcoin, and I, you know, that trade has obviously worked out phenomenally. I also know that you remain bullish on it, but you know, you're not sort of pounding the table for it, but you remain bullish on it. So I don't want to ask you about that. I want to ask you about NFTs, non-fungible tokens, which have been on an absolute tear. And I actually don't know if I've seen you on Twitter or heard you anywhere else share your views on them. You know, we recently had a work of art from Beeple be sold for $69 million. Now, after that sale was completed, I believe Beeple said it's a bubble. It's interesting that they didn't say it's a bubble before it was sold. But, you know, you have Tony Hawk having an NFT, and it kind of reminds me of the SPACs where it's like, oh, yeah, Shaquille O'Neal has a SPAC. Paul Ryan has a SPAC. A-Rod has a SPAC. You know, what's your take, Lynn, on these NFTs?
So I think the NFTs is where a lot of the excess in the crypto space has happened in recent months. And so a lot of people refer to Bitcoin as a bubble, but I don't really view that space as a bubble at the current time. A lot of those people are dollar cost averaging in. They have really long-term views. Whereas the mania has really been in the NFT space, in my opinion. And so on one hand, it's interesting technology because, you know, for people that have collectibles, you know, sometimes they do have silly prices, and that's part of being a collectible. And so, for example, the example I use is that I have Magic the Gathering cards, and some of them are silly in price compared to the cardboard that they're printed on. And that's because there's utility to them in the game, or some of the really old ones they have you know, value because they're not being made any more of. And so there's only a finite amount. And so collectibles, of course, you know, are going to have value as long as their whatever made them a collectible in the first place stays relevant. Now, the question is, you know, NFTs are kind of a unique expression of that. And so it makes sense on one hand that as we've digitized our world, we would have digitized collectibles. I think the thing to watch out for is some of the details. And so on one hand, it enables a lot of things. And so, for example, I'm always in favor of technologies that give the artist or the creator, whether it's music or visual or all these different mediums, more control over their product, a larger share of the income they can get from it, basically factoring out the middleman, giving them different tools to go straight to the public. So I'm always in favor of that. There's also unique things where, you know, let's say an artist sells a piece of art, they get a small amount for it, and then if it later sells for a different amount, that doesn't affect them. Whereas with NFTs, you can do all sorts of interesting programming things, like you can get a recurring stream from later sales and things like that. So I definitely think it's an area that's really worth exploring and seeing what's going to become of it. But of course, as you explore these things, the market's kind of prone to excesses. And so, you know, we saw back in 2017, the ICO bubble where everything had to be an ICO. And so now everything's got to be an NFT. And so I think the risk is that, even some aspects of this technology have staying power, that doesn't necessarily mean that like a little 8-bit GIF, you know, a little bit 8-bit picture is going to be worth the $1 million, you know, 5 years from now that it was paid for, you know, this at this point. And so I do think that you know, the vast majority probably won't hold their value. There's also kind of details that I've compared before, whereas if you look at a traditional piece of artwork, you know, partly it's the you know, the artist himself, but you know, a lot of times the artist does not, you know, their works don't become expensive until after the artist passes away. Because in some ways, that's when they've proven the scarcity of their pieces of art. They can no longer paint the same picture again. they know how many pictures, you know, roughly, and there could be hidden works, you know, found. But overall, that's when those artists, you know, and sadly become rich, is after they're no longer benefiting from it. And so one of the downsides of NFTs is that, you know, you don't know how many artworks the living author is going to create. You know, there's no, you know, they could potentially reissue the same artwork on another blockchain. You know, they basically could violate trust of the user. You're also basically betting on the longevity of the underlying blockchain. And so, for example, you can say there was a Picasso, but it was made in a certain type of paint or that is disintegrating faster than, you know, people thought at the time. And so therefore, an otherwise good piece of work could be, you know, made worthless by the fact that it disintegrates more quickly than expected. Similarly, if you're buying an NFT, you're basically betting on the longevity of the underlying blockchain in a similar way that you're betting on the longevity of the paint and the canvas of a piece of art. And so overall, I think it's an area that's fraught with risk and speculation. And so I would kind of, you know, just encourage people to be very selective in how much capital they put into that and to be really kind of tame with their expectations. Where I think it's a fun place to dabble in, but I'd be very cautious about, you know, serious capital investments.
Wise words. And, you know, Lynn, what you said about what blockchain it's on, I believe most of them are on Ethereum. It's my understanding that you are pronouncedly way more bullish on Bitcoin than you are on Ethereum. You know, people who are Ethereum say, oh, well, you can do all these smart contracts. It's not like Bitcoin, where Bitcoin, you can kind of just send it to people and that's really it. Lynn, to just do a little bit of a plug, it's my understanding that this week for the Real Vision Crypto Gathering, you are actually speaking to Elizabeth Stark, the CEO and founder of the Lightning Network, who is, when the Lightning Network, the goal of that is basically to be an application layer on top of Bitcoin. Do you want to quickly talk about that?
Sure, yeah. She's the CEO of Lightning Labs, which is, they make some of the tools for the Lightning Network. And so the Lightning Network is like Bitcoin, where it's not owned by anyone, but there are companies that make tools for it or that make different sort of protocols. And so whenever you hear about a really cool app that's out there that's using Lightning, chances are they're a customer of Lightning Labs that is kind of doing the underlying technology that makes a lot of that possible. So that there's basically easier ways and more liquid ways to interact with the Lightning network. Basically, as Bitcoin continues to grow, Lightning is the scaling network on top of that, and allows all sorts of things, like you can think of like the Strike app, for example, that allows for kind of international payments very cheaply. There's also things like Sphinx Chat, where you're basically using Lightning as a form of communication, and so it's really kind of exciting technologies that can kind of upend some of the legacy systems we have now. And it can even, utilize smart contracts, essentially. I mean, at its core, Lightning is essentially a smart contract layer. It's just an interesting thing that makes Bitcoin more than just digital gold. It makes it potentially a payment network, but then also allows for, smaller investors to get around the problematic transaction fees that can happen if Bitcoin is very successful.
Yeah, that's fascinating stuff. I'll leave a link in the description so people can sign up to the Crypto Gathering if they haven't already. Lynn, as always, it's been phenomenal having you on the Daily Briefing. Thanks so much. People can find you at lynnalden.com as well as on your Twitter handle at Lynn Alden. Contact Lynn. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.